We are down to the last speaker, last but not least. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Leon Schumacher. He is a professor of agricultural systems management here at University of Missouri Columbia. He's going to be talking to us about using biodiesel as a lubricity additive for petroleum diesel fuel. Dr. Schumacher.
See if I can master the technology here. I'm not so sure. It looks like it was moving ahead on its own. Anyway, as early as 2002, we realized that there was some change in the wind in terms of the diesel fuel, and that directive that came down from DOE basically mandated that we look at a little different type of diesel fuel. And the end result was that diesel fuel was low in lubricity. So then you may, in fact, let me get it right here, you may, in fact, ask yourself, well, what might that lubricity really entail? I have a couple of different definitions here, and you can find others in the literature, but in essence, in a diesel fuel system, the diesel fuel was really providing a lubricating vehicle, if you will, to keep those components from wearing out prematurely. So what we really walked through prior to 1993, we had as low as 5,000 parts per million sulfur, and then after 93 we ratcheted that down to 500, and then after June 1 of 2006, and it really did happen about that time frame, it was dropped down to 15 parts per million. Now the advantage of that came to us in terms of what we saw in terms of emissions out the exhaust pipe and so on, cleaner running engines and so on. But ultimately, when that occurred, we had some hydrotreating technologies that were really having an impact on the fuel itself, which impacted the levels of oxygen and nitrogen in that fuel, and the end result was a fuel that wasn't performing as well in terms of lubricating quality. The biggest hitter was probably to what we would call a rotary distributor type fuel injection system. It really didn't bother, really didn't impact the what we call an inline pump as well. And that was really why for about a period of 4 years, Cummins and others really walked away from the rotary style injection pump that they were using and used the more expensive Bosch inline pump. Some different ways that we could give an analysis here. One way might be to use a vehicle. Another might be to use a bench test type procedure. Still yet another might be to use an independent lab procedure. This particular test, as you can imagine, this pickup was purchased in 1992. We put 100,000 miles on the pickup, ran it on 100% biodiesel, removed the engine, shipped it to Cummins, they evaluated the condition of the engine and, of course, every system thereof associated with the engine. And they were very pleased with it. But the fact is, it took us over two and a half years to get to that point where we could actually determine what impact we might have occurring on that fuel injection system. The next step then would be, well, can you short circuit that a little bit? Well, we ended up using... Here we have an electric motor. It's actually a 10 horsepower electric motor that we were using to actually drive an injection pump. It was the inline injection pump. Across the top here is where you're actually seeing the injectors. And by so doing, we were able to circumvent actually operating the engine. Now this actually moves it down to about a 3-month process. And of course, at that point in time, then those components right up here, the injection pump and the injectors and all, were shipped back to Cummins. They in turn did an evaluation on those injectors. So then the next procedure that we really kind of settled in on then is what I would call the laboratory test. And in this scenario, this device allows us to get a feel for the lubricity of that product in a very short period of time. Data is available within 1 week. Of course, it doesn't come without cost. I mean, they're typically charging about $170, or so dollars for one test. Okay, keep in mind as we do research, we'd like to have, you know, 7 or 8 tests so we have a more representative look at what's really taking place. So one test on a fuel could inadvertently put you in a position where it was a significant sum of money, having the test done at another location. So the two tests that emerged, the SL Bockel test, the SL Bockel was really developed at Southwest Research Institute. Paul Lacey was the individual who masterminded and did so much of the work on this particular system. The other test was what we call the high frequency reciprocating rig. That's what the letters stand for there. And that in turn resulted in two ASTM test procedures. For some time there was controversy among the engine companies, which one should we use? To give you a little closer look, this is a photograph of the Bockel tester and what is now Magellan Labs in Kansas City, Kansas. And this is the description of the image that's in the ASTM test procedure. I essentially lifted it off of here. And what we're really saying is if we can suspend 3,100 grams without scuffing, and I'm going to walk into that in just a moment, but you can see here a ball that's brought down on a cylinder that's rotating in a fluid here that's kept at a certain temperature. Those different elements allow us to determine whether or not there's still any lubrication occurring right where that ball meets that rotating ring. The conditions with which this moves its specific volume of fuel, 50 milliliters, you can see the temperature that we need to have it maintain, relative humidity, the mass that we're going to start with, the ring itself has a specific RPM, and then we're going to look at what we call the tangential force. In other words, we have a load cell in this location right here, and as the rotation takes place, you can see the ring in this location right here. As it actually shears on through and actually begins wearing on that ring, that causes a what we call tangential force to be recorded by a computer. And you can see how it spiked in the illustration here. And at that point, we're saying that's when we need to really stop because we've actually added more weight than what the system will sustain. To look at the HFRR test, it's similar but yet much different. Here you can see we are going to reciprocate a steel ball a distance of 1 millimeter at 50 hertz under a specific load for 75 minutes. Okay, this test was actually developed in England at one of the universities. The volume of fuel is much smaller, 2 rather than 50 milliliters, 2 different temperatures we can operate at. The non-rotating ball is lowered with the mass on top, the 200 grams, ball contacts the disc and fuel, and this stroke for at 50 hertz for 75 minutes actually results in wear on the ball itself. That then is measured using a microscope under 100x magnification. So that really leads us to then what were the goals of this activity. I've kind of given you the background of the different procedures we wanted to use and such. We wanted to first verify the composition of the new diesel fuel that was soon to be marketed. Of course, it's been out now for a couple of years. And to determine the amount of biodiesel that would be added so that we could actually move ahead. You know, a lot of individuals are advocating a 20% biodiesel blend and so on. So what might be the best combination? The fuel itself, this was really critical. Yeah, we were able to secure the biodiesel fuel from a known producer, high-quality product, and so on. But what was more important was that we were able to secure the diesel fuel, a diesel fuel that had not been additized, a diesel fuel that met what we call certification standards. That meant then we had a specific lot of fuel. To get this fuel in was actually more expensive than to get the biodiesel in. And even though everybody would always come back and say that biodiesel is expensive on a gallon basis, yes, but to get this specific volume and get it shipped to us in a 55-gallon drum, a little expensive. Now, the first thing we wanted to do was to actually mix these on a volume-per-volume kind of basis. So we moved ahead and used a scale here, electronic scale, determine the, if you will, the density of the fuels. And then we went ahead and began mixing these on a volume per volume basis. We did additional tests other than these. This year was with what we would call number two fuel, but you can see a 0.5%, 1%, 2%. And, you know, so many times we're seeing that people are advocating up to 20% biodiesel. We wanted to see if we just put a very small amount in there, what would be the impact. At the same time we began this work, there really wasn't a number one fuel that was really a comparable product to the CERT fuel. The only fuel that we were able to secure was really what I would call equivalent of a JP8 type fuel, like a fuel for an airplane, if you will. And that fuel was, well, we had some interesting results. I could share those at a later time if you wanted. To give a look here then, it kind of gives you a kind of a layout. Fuel density with the diesel fuel and biodiesel. We went ahead, mathematically computed these volumes, and then we determined that we needed 32.09 grams and 3,009.2 grams. So this then became the mixture that allowed us to put the fuel blends together. Okay, analysis then. In the company at the time that we worked with was Williams. They're now Magellan. I don't know if some of you have worked with Magellan. It's probably the only lab in all of the state that is able to do a complete biodiesel analysis. The state lab in Jefferson City has all of the equipment, if you will, to do all the analysis except the cetane analysis, because the cetane analysis on biodiesel really needs to be done with a cetane engine as opposed to using a distillation curve to arrive at what the cetane would probably be. We went ahead and transported the fuel to Kansas City, Kansas for the analysis. And I'm not going to walk through all of this. I think that's quite overkill, a little bit redundant, if you will. But you can note here was the ASTM spec for biodiesel in the center column. And then here was the results that we received back from Williams at the time. It gives you kind of a look as to where that biodiesel fell. And really, the biodiesel met or exceeded all the expectations of the current standard when we conducted the work. And here's just the tail end of the results. Now, when we looked at the diesel, again, here we have the D975 standard, which was in place at the time for diesel fuel. You can see here that Chevron itself, they provided us a cursory review of what those specifications would be. We went ahead and reevaluated that to determine how close those were when we did the work. And again, you know, the fuel fell within the specifications for D975. Now, to give a look here, biodiesel blends, as you chase down this path, Cummins would say if you had a 3,100 gram classification, that you'd be in a very good position in terms of lubricity. The problem, though, with this test procedure that people looked at from the very beginning, that this test procedure was really more of a hands-on type test procedure, really wasn't automated. Now, at this point in time, you can buy equipment that is automated, but in the beginning, it really wasn't an automated system. So the analytical variation, the test, could vary from 300 to 1,500 grams, which is significant, which would mean that even the 3,500, if 3,100 was a cutoff, may or may not meet the standard. Of course, the 100% biodiesel put us right where we wanted to be. We were far exceeding the 3,100 grand, even if the analytical variation was off the chart. Now, I incorporated one more slide. This work was done at a later time, and here you have the average wear scar. And you can see on the far left, we've got D100, 95, and the screen's kind of spun a little bit, 90, is it 85? Mm-hmm. And the last one is 100, okay. And so all of these are below the spec. The spec would be 0.450 or 0.456. All of these are below the spec. Now, the reason I'm bringing and pushing this slide is because I was working with a student on what we call an undergraduate research internship. We have several of those kinds projects that we work with students on, undergraduate students. We want them to get familiar with and begin looking at research as a profession, you know. And the end result, you can see, even the D100 met that standard. Now, all the work that I'd done previous to that would suggest that this should have been 0.65. So what that's telling me is that when the student went and secured the fuel, he secured the fuel at the pump. And what happened, of course, which really fell in line with the recommendations that we had, that the lubricity of the low sulfur fuel number two didn't meet the minimum lubricity standard established by Cummins. The reason on the previous slide here that it actually met that was because they had put different additives in there. And then substitutions of small quantities resulted in a product that would meet those standards. As far as recommendations, at the time we were working on this effort, we were confident that a lubricity additive would essentially have to be used, and that replacing 1% or more with the number two fuel raised the fuel to a level that wouldn't cause damage to the diesel fuel injection system. I tried to keep on time, so
appreciate that.
Yeah.